Animals Today Radio is made possible in part by a generous grant from International Society for Animal Rights, ISARonline.org. Welcome to Animals Today, your home for serious talk about animals. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. About 5 years ago, convicted felon Michael Vick was released from prison for dogfighting. And less than 5 months after that, he was back on the field playing for the Eagles in the NFL. It sickened me then, and I'm still disgusted with how easy he got off. Listen to what I said at the time. Okay, so we have been discussing and hearing about the Michael Vick dogfighting pro football story on the news and online, and even in my household a lot these days, and I have to tell you right off that I am very disappointed in the NFL for letting this king of animal abuse slide back into the spotlight so easily. Actually, I'm really PO'd about this. When Vick was arrested or sentenced, what did you think was going to happen to him when he got out of prison? Well, I don't really know the workings of the NFL very well, but no way did I think he'd be back in uniform days after his release. After all, these were horrible things he did, not just the dog fighting, which is one of the most horrific forms of animal cruelty I can think of, but how about drowning and electrocuting and beating dogs to death? And he encouraged others to be involved in these activities. Now, I know all the objections to my point of view. He paid his time. He has the right to make a living. America loves a comeback story. He deserves a second chance. Blah, blah, blah. But for me, I just can't stomach that. Here is a guy who, in my opinion, has absolutely no human decency, who is only sad for getting caught, and whose apologies are so transparently scripted. It just makes me sick looking at his face, let alone be given back a national and international stage. Now, you guys might know that the Humane Society of the United States, led by Wayne Pacelli, is going to be teaming up with Vick on their ongoing anti-dog fighting campaign. But, you know, Wayne, I just have to disagree with you on this one. Vick clearly is just going through the motions. He doesn't care about the animals. He's not rehabilitated. I just don't think it's possible to make an effective role model out of this guy. Listen, I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But I don't think so. I do think, however, on one positive note in all this, that because of Mr. Vick and his unthinkable cruel crimes committed on these innocent animals, the public became more aware of dogfighting. Many people now know, maybe even for the first time, that dogfighting does exist, and it's everywhere, even in our own Coachella Valley. And this widespread awareness and the prevalence of this illegal activity is a good thing. And hopefully, because of this heightened awareness about the blood sport, more individuals will not hesitate to report to law enforcement, either witnessed or even suspected cases of animal cruelty or illegal animal fighting. Do you remember a few months ago it was mentioned that when it was time for NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell to consider Michael Vick's potential return to professional football, he'd be looking for evidence that Vick is truly sorry for his crime. Goodell stated, and I quote, "I think it's clear he paid a price, but to a large extent it's going to have to demonstrate to the larger community, not just to the NFL community and to me, that he has remorse for what he did and that he recognizes mistakes that he made." Well, last month, Roger Goodell conditionally restored Vick to the league after meeting with Vick and hearing his apology. I mean, what a ridiculous charade. The league obviously wanted him back and devised a way to make it happen without creating too much backlash against the NFL. The NFL wants its cash cow back in uniform. No offense to our cows intended. In his 60 Minutes interview, I don't know if you guys caught this, Vic also talked about his time in prison, saying he had time to think about what he had done, realizing what he had lost. He said that often he cried at night in his cell. Poor baby. You're crying all alone in your cell, Michael. Why were you crying, Michael? Why were you crying? Were you crying because you felt badly for the dogs when you brutally tortured and beaten them to death? Or were you crying because you blew a multi-million-dollar contract, wrecked your fairy tale life, and was caught doing something you clearly enjoy, which was torturing and abusing and killing dogs? The interviewer on 60 Minutes, James Brown, commented to Michael. He said, Michael, so for the cynics who will say, you know what, I don't know, Michael Vick might be more concerned about the fact that his career was hurt than the dogs were hurt, which I thought was an excellent remark made by James Brown. And Vic responded, quote, I mean, football don't even matter. Oh, really, Mr. Convicted Felon? Football don't even matter? If it don't even matter, then why didn't you turn down NFL's offer? You can't fool me. You can't fool me with your scripted interview that you must have practiced over and over again trying to convince the public that you feel remorse for what you did. You don't even act remorse well, Michael. Go practice some more. Maybe you'll convince a few more people that you're sorry for what you've done. You're sorry for getting caught. That's what you're sorry for. And I'm convinced that Michael Vick has absolutely no remorse for the suffering and terror and pain he's inflicted upon those innocent animals. Do I think that he's a changed man or has the capability of ever being a changed man? Heck no. A man that would not hesitate for years doing all those horrible things to dogs that you have read about and you've heard about, and now, after serving less than 2 years behind bars, he wants to hug and love and respect dogs? No way! Once a psychopath, always a psychopath.
You know, a few weeks ago on Animals Today, we spoke about the disgraced NFL star Michael Vick, who was released from federal prison a few weeks ago after spending 19 months behind bars for his role in a dog-fighting operation. And I won't repeat myself by telling you how I feel about this low life of a human being who sparked national outrage after admitting hanging, drowning, and beating to death dogs that had not performed up to his standards in the fights. But the point to my little rant about him was that because of his case, more attention has been paid to dog fighting, and people became more aware that this incredibly brutal, sadistic contest is still happening frequently and everywhere today. And not only that, some people did not even know what dog fighting is. I mean, you see on the news home videos of people or children being forced to fight each other and beat the hell out of each other, and we see those cage fighting events where two people voluntarily choose to fight in a cage, and it's stopped, of course, when someone taps out or the referee puts an end to it before someone actually gets killed. But I don't think we ever saw, or at least I hadn't, an actual dog fighting event being played during the Vic coverage. And you know why? Way too brutal and violent. There's no way they could show that on TV. Not even if they stated their little disclaimer or whatever you want to call it, where they say, warning, what you're about to watch is incredibly violent, so you better not watch this. I was at an animal cruelty education conference several years ago, and they showed a home video of a dog fighting event. It was the most violent, disgusting, heartbreaking film I'd ever seen in my entire life. I couldn't stand to watch it. I left the room in tears. And you got to believe me when I say I was not the only one in the room that was affected and sickened by what we saw. We know dog fighting is a form of animal cruelty, and many would consider it one of the worst forms of animal cruelty. Dog fighting is a contest in which two dogs are specifically bred and trained to fight with each other for the sole purpose of entertainment and gambling. The pit bulls is the breed of dogs specifically bred and used in the majority of these fights because of their extremely powerful and strong jaws. And thus, they're able to inflict severe injuries. Dogs used in these events often die of blood loss, dehydration, shock, exhaustion. And not too infrequently, they die of infection hours or even days after the fight. It is a horrible form of animal cruelty. Usually these fights take place in a small homemade arena, in backyards or in basements. I found it quite interesting, well, sickening, of course, but interesting, when we spoke last week on Animals Today about debarking or devocalizing a dog, and our guest was explaining that many of the individuals that run these dogfighting operations have this cruel and unethical procedure done to these dogs so as to keep their illegal dogfighting operation under wrap. Because we all know now that this activity is illegal, and not only is dogfighting illegal, but it's strongly tied to other illegal activities, such as gambling and drugs and gangs. Actually, gang members view pit bulls as a must-own complement to their image, just as Paris Hilton needs her little chihuahua or whatever she has as a lifestyle accessory to define her image. Gang members view pit bulls as their lifestyle accessories and complementary to the image they desire. And you know this homemade film of a dogfight at the conference I told you about, which I attended, I failed to tell you something else that was incredible for me to see. There were young children present during the spectacle, being entertained, amused, rooting for a dog to viciously kill the other dog. And all I could think about for weeks to follow, literally what was ingrained in my brain, was, number one, those poor dogs and how they appeared. And number two, those children. What did the children learn from watching this? Insensitivity to animal suffering? Enthusiasm for violence and cruelty? Encouragement of illegal activities, including drugs and gambling? Isn't it terrible to think about what kind of adults they're going to grow up to be? We know and spoke about this strong connection between animal cruelty and human violence. What kind of values will these children have about everything? One last thing you should know. Dog fighters use bait animals to train their dogs. Bait animals are often stolen family pets. Your dog and cat and my dog and cat. Or animals that are given away free in advertisements and newspapers. These pit bull dogs used and trained for fighting are trained to be dangerously aggressive towards other animals. And the presence of these very dogs in the community that were trained to be aggressive towards animals obviously increases the risk of attacks not only on other animals, but also on people and children.
After the break, we're going to learn about the connection between animal cruelty and interpersonal violence with Dr. Randall Lockwood.
If you're like most people, you have lots of plans. A financial plan, an eating plan, an exercise plan, a career plan. You also need a plan for the care of your pets when you're no longer able to provide it. Every day, animals are sent to shelters, terrified and confused, or they're euthanized because their owners have become incapacitated or died. Some people don't give the future a thought. Others assume family members will care for their pets. A better way is to name caregivers and provide detailed instructions about your pal's feeding, play, social, and health care needs. But even family and designated caregivers don't guarantee that pets will have a home. Good intentions intentions sometimes take a backseat to life's realities, such as a new spouse who doesn't like animals, a sudden desire to travel the world, or the adoptive caregiver's own infirmity. A legally enforceable pet trust offers the only assurance that your assets will be used as you wish to provide for the comfort and care of cherished animal companions. More than 40 states recognize pet trusts. Check with your attorney, accountant, or state legislator to see if yours does and how to create one. Animals Today urges you to plan for your pet's lifelong well-being. Take steps today so he or she doesn't risk becoming yet another sad shelter statistic.
You're listening to America's Talk Radio Network, where America talks.
A few years ago, I interviewed Dr. Randall Lockwood about the causes of animal cruelty. Here it is.
Dr. Lockwood, I know it's such a huge field, but why don't you introduce the concept of the relationship between cruelty to animals and other violent acts done by people?
Sure. Well, this is not a new concept. Certainly, the idea that the way we treat animals is reflected in how we treat one another is part of most ethical treatments, a lot of religious writings and a lot of philosophical writings going back hundreds, if not thousands, of years. When Dr. Frank Ascione and I put together an edited volume of writings on this topic, we go back several hundred years to John Locke, drawing on articles from psychology, philosophy, anthropology, physiology, criminology, where professionals in many fields have really tried to confirm the basic notion that I think most of us have, that people who hurt animals are not nice people, or at least they are people who we need to be concerned about, who have the potential for violence against others.
How is animal abuse similar to violence against people and similar to domestic and child abuse? There must be many parallels, correct?
There are many parallels, and one of my concerns originally going back 30 years is that, you know, when you look back at the early days of animal protection organizations, in local humane societies, very often the person who was investigating cruelty to animals was also kind of the conscience of the community. Reading the log books of cruelty investigators from the turn of the century, they might try to catch a rabid dog. They might break up a fight between boys at a schoolyard. They might track down a deadbeat dad who'd run away from his family without leaving support. He might then rescue injured dogs. And what happened over the last 100 years or so was all those different societal systems for dealing with cruelty became separated into the categories of victims. So we have child protection agencies, we have domestic violence responders, we have elder abuse investigators and animal cruelty. And often people were not making the connection that often it was the same perpetrator. So it really was about 25 or 30 years ago that people started looking at it from the standpoint of the offender rather than the victim, saying, mm-hmm. Who are these people? And that's when we started to see a high degree of overlap, that it is often the same people who are involved in child abuse, domestic violence, elder abuse, and animal cruelty. And that's when we started kind of looking at, well, what are the psychological roots? Where is this coming from? And often it is about power and control. That's one of the things that seems to unite the different forms of violence, that often the triggers for cruelty and abuse are related to the individual just feeling that he, and we're usually talking about he as an intentional cruelty offender, the triggers often involve him feeling that somehow he's not being respected, he's not in control, and seeking to gain control or maintain control over others through violence. And that's one of the things that does pull them together.
So, Dr. Lockwood, if you look at adult violent offenders as a group, are they more likely to have been animal abusers as youths?
There have been many studies, and actually a new one just came out this week, looking at some of this, and repeatedly, most of these studies do show that people with a history of interpersonal violence are much more likely to have a childhood history or early adult history of repeated acts of gratuitous animal cruelty, and might often involve other antisocial behaviors like and criminal behaviors like fire setting. Studies I've been involved in looking at, well, there are two ways you can do this. You can start out with a population of people who you know have been cruel to animals and then follow them for many years. And that's difficult to do, particularly going back a few years, because there weren't that many people being charged, and it is very hard to track people for 5 or 10 years. But that was done by the Massachusetts SPCA, beginning with data that was collected in the 1970s following close to 250 offenders. And what they found was that compared to people who were matched controls, meaning people the same age, sex, lived in the same neighborhood, same ethnic background, that compared to their matched controls, the animal abusers were about 5 times more likely to also be involved in other acts of interpersonal violence. About 4 times more likely to be involved in drug offenses, I think about two or three times more likely to be arrested drunk and disorderly. And you know, overall, there was a confirmation of this general picture of them as not nice, law-abiding people. What that particular study didn't clearly demonstrate was a progression that sometimes the crimes against animals had actually followed the crimes against people. So it's not necessarily a rehearsal or a progression. But we still think that is one common pattern, particularly for young offenders. That study did not involve a lot of young kids. Then the other way you can try to gather this information is start out with a population of offenders already and then look backward in their life history and see what happened there. And some of the studies that fail to show a connection are those that simply look up the arrest records of people in jail and look for arrests for animal cruelty, and you don't find them very often if that's all you do.
Dr. Lockwood, when a child grows up in a household with domestic abuse going on, what does it do to the psychology of the child?
Yeah, it's a very individual reaction, and we know that most violent offenders have come from backgrounds of abuse, but most abused children do not necessarily become violent offenders. So that's been one of the most interesting questions to us, is what is there for the folks who are exposed to violence and yet survive, gain strength. You know, so exposure to family violence can be very debilitating and create intergenerational violence, and that's a common result. But equally, or maybe not equally like, but also likely, is certainly many of the people that I meet who are in social services or in animal protection have come from backgrounds where they have experienced personal exposure to violence and basically have vowed not to let that happen to those in their care or their protection. So one of the things we are interested in is how can you overcome that background, and how can you empower victims to, in fact, not be victimizers, but be rescuers of those who might otherwise be victimized. And a lot of that has to do then with what resources are offered to them. Are there mentors? Are there, sometimes all it takes is one caring person, whether it is a grandparent or a relative or a teacher or just someone in the community that has reached out and helped the victims of violence.
Walks merrily down the street with the brim pool way down low. Ain't no sound but the sound of his feet. Machine guns ready to go. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat? Out of the doorway, the bullets rip.
Here's the problem. You're driving in the car, you don't feel secure. You don't have a gun in the glove compartment, but you want some personal security. The solution? The rechargeable flashlight stun gun. You heard me right. A beautiful black flashlight with a polyester sheath and a belt loop. It's gorgeous, military grade, has a great light, but here's the kicker. It also has a 300,000-volt stun gun built right at the tip. Now you have security. Now you have security. You're walking the dog, you're out and about, somebody comes up to the window of your car. You know in your glove compartment, you not only have a great rechargeable flashlight, but you've got a 300,000-volt stun gun to go. And it's rechargeable. No batteries required. You'll always have it ready to charge, ready to go, to give you personal security, to move your light. Give it to a kid in college. Give it to your daughter. Give it to your wife. Everybody should have a rechargeable flashlight, 300,000-volt stun gun. How much does it cost? $59.99. You can get yours for $59.99 by calling 1-888-877-0490. That's 1-888-877-0490. Go to mycoolgadgets.com. It's G-A-D-G-E-T-S.com. Mycoolgadgets.com. You heard me right. A rechargeable flashlight with a 300,000-volt stun gun built in the end. But hang on. If you act right now, not later, we won't give you one rechargeable flashlight stun gun. We'll give you two of them. You heard me right. Now they're $30 a piece. 1-888-877-0490. Call us now. 1-888-877-0490. Or go to mycoolgadgets.com. Buy one, get a second one for free. Rechargeable flashlight with a 300,000-volt stun gun to go, baby. Go to mycoolgadgets.com or call 1-888-877-0490. Call now. ACOS the Solutionist here. Imagine a device that constantly scans your house. It lets you know if there's an intruder getting in or out of your house, condo, or apartment. This spy versus spy technology is here. The activator simply plugs into any wall outlet of your home. You plug in a light, TV, or radio. When anyone's trying to enter your home, bang, the lights turn on, the stereo turns on, whatever you plug into the activator turns on. Imagine the intruder being welcomed with light and sound. They're out of there. Not only that, when you come home in the dark, the lights turn on for you. The house welcomes you, hugs you. It's like not living home alone anymore. Normally, one activator costs $60, but this exclusive radio offer cuts the price in half and doubles it. That's two activators, $120 value for only $29.99. Call 1-888-877-0490. That is 1-888-877-0490. Or go to mycoolgadgets.com. That's mycoolgadgets.com. Here's the problem. Nail polish, hair dye, graffiti, tar. How do you get those stains out? Use Stains Are Out. Any stain, anywhere. Nail polish, oil, lipstick, pet stains, old stains, any stains, this will get your stain out. In fact, if it doesn't get your stain out, we'll buy the bottle back from you. Made with natural banana oil, oil from the skin of a banana, biodegradable and organic, Stains Are Out is the solution. Pour it on and get your stain out. Normally, bottle of Stains Are Out sells for $29.99. Hyper concentrated, each bottle will make 16 bottles of stain remover. $29.99 for 16 bottles of dilution. And here's the deal. If you buy a bottle of Stains Are Out right now, we'll give you three bottles. That's 48 bottles worth. That's the deal. Buy one, get three bottles for $29.99. Call 1-888-877-0490 or go to mycoolgadgets.com.
You're listening to America's Talk Radio Network, where America talks.
Welcome back to Animals Today. We are continuing our discussion with Dr. Randall Lockwood about animal cruelty, and he's reviewing the warning signs that somebody is or might become an animal abuser.
The other thing that is a warning sign or a danger sign is that if someone is gaining a sense of empowerment through the suffering of others and it has no consequences for them other than to make them feel empowered, that's the particularly dangerous thing. That's, you know, the famous quote from Margaret Mead that the worst thing that can happen to a child is to, you know, violently kill an animal and get away with it.
Right.
It is the getting away with it that is the issue there, and is the common thread that we see in the childhood histories of a lot of violent offenders.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Dr. Lockwood, so any advice for parents of an otherwise normal kid? Let's say throwing rocks at a stray cat versus throwing rocks at a disliked schoolmate. Should parents treat these situations differently?
Yeah, and I think they certainly have to be seen as red flags and cries for help. That the child who is seeking to again gain the sense of power by hurting something is sending a message that he feels out of control. He feels a need for control. The reality is that also sometimes it's a teachable moment. It depends also on the age of the kid. You know, I often see out at the Washington Mall, we have a large sprawling grassy area that attracts lots of pigeons, and it's a pretty common thing to see, you know, little kids chasing the pigeons to make them fly away.
Right.
Kids throw rocks to make them fly away, and then very interested in seeing how the parents react. And,
exactly.
And often it's the child that has absolutely, you know, where he's learning for himself, oh, I throw rocks at something, I get a reaction out of them, and no one steps in and says that scares them, or how would you feel if things were big things were throwing rocks at you.
Yeah, good point.
And it's a teachable moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, in many ways, the kids that are left to their own devices to find a source of stimulation and empowerment and do so through causing fear and pain and suffering to animals, they're sort of like the dog that's left chained by himself.
Yeah.
And as people go by, he lunges at the chain and growls and barks and responds aggressively, and the people run away. And because he's been unsupervised, he's basically taught himself that showing aggression gives me power and control.
Yeah.
And I often say to people, you don't need to teach a dog to become vicious. They're capable of teaching them themselves that if they're in an environment that is reinforcing that.
So
we do have to take advantage of those opportunities to teach kids empathy and compassion and viewing animals as sentient creatures.
Wonderful point. Are there socioeconomic factors that influence the likelihood of animal abuse?
Not really.
Yeah.
We have seen our violent offenders. It's sort of not unlike the demographics of domestic violence. And, you know, some people look upon domestic violence as being something that's more associated with poverty and so on. And there's a little bit of a connection there, partly because the violence comes from a lack of a sense of lack of control and empowerment. But we certainly see many instances of child abuse, elder abuse, and domestic violence at all levels. The classic study I was involved in looking at how pets were treated in child-abusing families was actually done in Princeton, New Jersey area with essentially middle and upper middle-class families, which were experiencing both child abuse and animal cruelty. So I think we certainly need to be careful about just saying, well, that's animal cruelty goes along with poverty. It certainly can be associated with other things, and one of which is going to be the lack of parental supervision. If you aren't engaged with your kids, if the kids aren't in school, if the kids are in schools where they're not, don't have a good mentoring relationship with teachers, if they don't have a community that is giving them some guidance, sure, there's greater opportunity for essentially teaching themselves to find sources of empowerment.
How common is organized dog fighting in the United States, and when and how do participants get involved?
Yeah, well, it's very common. I think we do see it in virtually every state and have had arrests in almost every state just in the last few years. We talk about a couple of different forms of dog fighting, the organized or professional or hobbyists that devote a lot of their time and money to this. And then what is definitely on the rise is the less organized street fighting, where we'll have two or three or four individuals getting involved in an impromptu fight, often in a schoolyard or abandoned building. That really seems to be on the rise and is seen in virtually every major city. These days, that level of fighting is associated more with gang activity, with drug activity with other neighborhood control issues. The more organized fighting, both cockfighting and dogfighting, has been around since pre-Civil War times and used to be more associated with rural or suburban America, and often was more common in the Southeast, but also found it somewhat in the Midwest, in Ohio and Missouri. How people get involved, again, it's like any other illegal enterprise for a variety of reasons. For some, it is the old-timers really did see it as a sport, and they did see the dogs as athletes and as an investment, and gave them bragging rights, but also income. And money is a major factor for dog fighting. There can be tens of thousands of dollars wagered in a single fight, and it's not unusual for authorities to find tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars when raiding a major dog fight. These days also it is about bragging rights, turf battles, and again the monetary basis of it has shifted a little bit in that we do see drugs involved with virtually every dogfight raid, and probably in about a fourth of the dogfight operations that are raided do result in the seizure of illegal weapons as well.
Yes.
So again, there's that general criminality that goes along with it,
right?
And as before, not necessarily characteristic of any particular cultural group. I think one of the mistakes that that I've seen recently is people, certainly given the Michael Vick case and others, have talked about this being part of black or inner city culture, which simply it's not an accurate reflection of. Until fairly recently, it was very rare to find African Americans involved in dogfighting. Until about 10 or 15 years ago, it was pretty much a good old boy enterprise. But I think that started changing back in the mid-80s, partly with the rise of breed bans and pit bull bans, that when communities started defining pit bulls as outlaws, that provided the unintended consequence of giving people a very easy way to define themselves as outlaws. You get involved in dogfighting.
You're listening to Animals Today. Check us out at animalstodayradio.com, where you can listen to all our previously broadcast shows. That's animalstodayradio.com. Animals Today Radio is largely sponsored by the nonprofit animal welfare organization Advancing the Interests of Animals, AIAnimals.org, AIAnimals.org. If you like this show, you like what you're hearing, please consider supporting Advancing the Interest of Animals by making a donation through their website, AIAnimals.org. And you can like us on Facebook.
Fly, Robin, fly.
ACOS, the solutionist here. Imagine a device that constantly scans your house. It lets you know if there's an intruder getting in or out of your house, condo, or apartment. This spy versus spy technology is here. The activator simply plugs into any wall outlet of your home. You plug in a light, TV, or radio. When anyone's trying to enter your home, bang, the lights turn on. The stereo turns on. Whatever you plug into the activator turns on. Imagine the intruder being welcomed with light and sound. They're out of there. Not only that, when you come home in the dark, the lights turn on for you. The house welcomes you, hugs you. It's like not living home alone anymore. Normally, one activator costs $60, but this exclusive radio offer cuts the price in half and doubles it. That's two activators, $120 value for only $29.99. Call 1-888-877-0490. That is 1-888-877-0490, or go to mycoolgadgets.com. That's mycoolgadgets.com.
This is Dave Shistokas with some very important information for business owners and nonprofit managers in the U.S. Gulf Coast area. Were you in operation at the time of the BP oil spill in April 2010? There's a very short period until June 8th to file a claim in the BP settlement. There are misunderstandings about the settlement. Organizations located well inland, unrelated to tourism or hospitality, are eligible, and there's no need to show that the oil spill was related to their damages. There's no dollar limits on claims to be paid under the settlement. BP is legally bound to pay all valid claims. Call me, Dave Shistokas, for a free evaluation of your potential claim at 312-451-5550. Any claim not filed by June 8th will be gone forever. There's no cost to find out about your eligibility at 312-451-5550 or visit shistokas.com for more. It's S-H-E-S-T-O-K-A-S.com. It takes time to properly prepare a claim, so quick action is critical.
Here's the problem. Nail polish, hair dye, graffiti, tar. How do you get those stains out? Use Stains Are Out. Any stain, anywhere. Nail polish, oil, lipstick, pet stains, old stains, any stains. This will get your stain out. In fact, if it doesn't get your stain out, we'll buy the bottle back from you. Made with natural banana oil. Oil from the skin of a banana. Biodegradable and organic. Stains Are Out is the solution. Pour it on and get your stain out. Normally, a bottle of Stains Are Out sells for $29.99. Hyper-concentrated, each bottle will make 16 bottles of stain remover. $29.99 for 16 bottles of dilution. And here's the deal. If you buy a bottle of Stains Are Out right now, we'll give you three bottles. That's 48 bottles worth. That's the deal. Buy one, get three bottles for $29.99. Call 1-888-877-0490 or go to mycoolgadgets.com.
You got any ideas?
I have a great idea.
Pitch it to me.
Hey, I got an idea.
Well, let's hear it.
Successful businesses start with great ideas and cool inventions. Hi, everybody. I'm John Cremins, the Doctor of Shopology. Join me and ACOS the Solutionist on My Cool Inventions every week. We continue our ongoing search for America's top invention. You could be the next one. Together, both ACOS and myself provide over 60 years of experience in the industry of inventing products and presenting them on shopping channels worldwide. Every show, we give our advice on how to successfully produce your product. Along with great information and featured industry guests, you'll also get a chance to listen to the inventors of some of the coolest inventions and vote on which projects you like. You be the shark. Now, if you have a $1 million idea in your head, submit it to us, and you can be selected to be on our show for your chance to be voted America's top invention. It's True Reality Radio, where you decide and regular American families like yours are lifted one innovation, one inventor, one American at a time.
Here's the problem. Nail polish, hair dye, graffiti, tar. How do you get those stains out? Use Stains Are Out. Any stain, anywhere. Nail polish, oil, lipstick, pet stains, old stains, any stains. This will get your stain out. In fact, if it doesn't get your stain out, we'll buy the bottle back from you. Made with natural banana oil, oil from the skin of a banana, biodegradable and organic, Stains Are Out is the solution. Pour it on and get your stain out. Normally, a bottle of Stains Are Out sells for $29.99. Hyper-concentrated, each bottle will make 16 bottles of stain remover. $29.99 for 16 bottles of dilution. And here's the deal. If you buy a bottle of Stains Are Out right now, we'll give you three bottles. That's 48 bottles worth. That's the deal. Buy one, get three bottles for $29.99. Call 1-888-877-0490 or go to mycoolgadgets.com.
Inventors, how would you like to have your product or invention featured on My Cool Inventions Radio? I'm going to tell you how. Hi, everybody. John Creeman's here. We'd love to see you in San Diego at the Response Expo at the Hilton San Diego Bayfront from April 21st to the 23rd. We're going to be talking to all of the inventors that have been amassed for this incredible show. Response Expo is the only place to gain access to the brightest leaders in direct, digital, and data-driven marketing. Response Expo is your gateway to top marketers, networks, even agencies, and service providers. You can be with us here live on My Cool Inventions Radio. You can meet us in person. We even have a way for you to get into the hall free. To get a hall badge, all you have to do is go to responseexpo.com. That's responseexpo.com. Register for a hall badge and then put in the promo code INVENT15. That's INVENT15. And you put that in the promo code, you'll actually get a free hall badge. Check it out. Meet us at the Response Expo April 21st through the 20th.
You're listening to America's Talk Radio Network, where America talks.
Welcome back. You're listening to my discussion with Dr. Randall Lockwood about animal cruelty, and we're talking about Michael Vick.
Now, you mentioned Michael Vick. I would like to bring him up. What specifically did he do? We know he was not just an ordinary participant. He was the ringleader, and he bankrolled the operation, correct?
Correct, and his actual conviction was for the conspiracy to organize the fight operations, not dogfighting itself. Dogfighting became a federal felony, actually, a month after he was arrested. So the tougher charge that could be levied against him at the time of his arrest was the conspiracy in trafficking, moving animals across state lines for purposes of fighting. And, you know, he fits in an unusual category in that the techniques that he and his colleagues were using, the way they were training animals, the kinds of animals they had on the site, and the way they were killing animals were what we see with street fighting. It was basically taking that street gang act of attitude, but applying it on a much larger scale, that he had 51 fighting dogs on his premises, and you know, most street fighters might have two or three. So at that level, he was like a professional, but the professionals showed much more interest in bloodlines, much more consistent training procedures. And if animals were not performing, they would usually be simply taken out and shot, not killed with the kind of violence and venom that was described in the indictments against Vic.
Oh, it's horrible.
And that's the kind of thing that we see, again, in street fights where animals are hung or electrocuted or bludgeoned or drowned. That's not something that we were traditionally seeing in mainstream, so to speak, dogfighting.
Yeah.
And that's what made the case, I think, particularly disturbing and particularly interesting to law enforcement.
Dr. Locke, would you care to speculate on what's going on in the mind of a wealthy star who runs a dogfighting operation? It just seems to me it's not just the cruelty involved, but personally reckless and risky.
Well, this is a big question that many people have raised specifically about Vic as someone who could have, who did have it all in terms of income and contacts,
right,
and yet his strongest motivation seemed to be staying true to his roots, and he had allegedly been involved with fighting dogs since pre-adolescence, since he was eight or nine. And part of his problems was his inability to separate from the boys back home, that whether that's just, you know, the loyalty that he felt to the people who had been with him through it all, to his entourage, but had not taken advantage of all the incredible opportunities available to him and had made many very bad decisions. That's why I'm somewhat skeptical about the sincerity of his rehabilitation. We'll see, because you know, he had had so many other opportunities to do the right thing for the community, to do the right thing for the kids he claims that he wants to inspire, but really has not, I don't think, has in his statements that come from himself, that come out of his own mouth, and not things that have been crafted for him by his attorneys. I've yet to see true evidence of empathy or compassion or realization of the harm he did to the animals.
Exactly. And do you think he just won't be an effective role model for kids like the Humane Society appears to believe
he certainly will attract an audience, he'll attract a crowd, but whether or not he had certainly been effective in raising public awareness about the problems of dogfighting, so to that extent he has performed a service, but whether or not he can reliably speak. One of the things, in general, looking at working with young offenders, the kind of scared straight programs or people speaking out, those kind of one-shot deals, it's sort of like the one-shot humane education lecture where you go in the classroom, say, be nice to your animals and spay, neuter them, and then leave. That doesn't really affect permanent change. What you really want to do is work at systemic change, that rather than giving a lecture to a class of potential offenders, Vic should be pouring some of his money into programs that provide pro-social positive opportunities for kids, not just working with animals, but in general. Kids get diverted into dogfighting as a source of potential empowerment, as a source of money, because there aren't any other real options. For him, the option to him was sports. For a lot of kids, that's not an option. And, he should be spending his resources to see what else can he do in these communities to elevate kids out of these issues.
You authored the book Prosecuting Animal Cruelty for the National District Attorneys Association. What are the challenges in these cases, Dr. Lockwood? How do prosecutors develop the expertise to deal with animal cruelty cases?
Two aspects. One is first overcoming internal political pressure to drop a case because it's only an animal. That's not as big an issue. And partly what we have to our advantage is the fact that most prosecutors are elected officials and they must respond to the will of the public. The question I'm asked by them constantly is, why do I get 20,000 emails on a dog burning case and yet I get no inquiries about a child abduction case? And partly that's because the public feels that the animals don't have any other advocate, that they have to step forward. So overcoming the resistance to take this seriously, and that's changed now that our animal cruelty laws are so much tougher. When animal cruelty was at best a misdemeanor in most states, most prosecutors wouldn't want to expend the resources. Investigating and prosecuting dogfighting is as difficult as cracking a drug ring and as dangerous for the investigators, and yet if it was just a misdemeanor where you might get 30 days in jail, there's very little incentive for law enforcement to move forward on that. Now that that is a federal felony as well as state felony in every state, there's much stronger incentive. So that's been a major improvement. And the other difficulty is that the animal cruelty cases are different, that the victims and the evidence are the same. The animal's body is both its evidence and the animal itself is a victim that must be cared for if still alive. And it's very important to have very good and accurate veterinary information.
This is Dr. Lori Kirshner encouraging you to nurture your love and compassion for the only other beings sharing our planet, the animals.
Animals Today Radio is made possible in part by a generous grant from International Society for Animal Rights, ISARonline.org.